This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Thank you for tuning in. I'm Joel Hilliker. I want to start today's show with a Tampa Bay Times article dated August 8th, 2019. When Andy Tuck ascended to the chairmanship of Florida's Board of Education in July, his board colleagues praised his dedication to public education, particularly his focus on the needs of rural students and schools. It didn't take long, though, for some activists with long memories to recall Tuck's 2008 position as a Highlands County School Board member opposing a proposal to include teaching evolution as a fact in the state's standards. This man was quoted as saying, "As a person of faith, I strongly oppose any study of evolution as fact at all. I'm purely in favor of it staying a theory and only a theory. I won't support any evolution being taught as fact at all in any of our schools." Mr. Tuck reiterated these doubts in 2014 when Florida Citizens for Science blogger Brandon Haught asked him about the issue. And these comments resurfaced, and he took a lot of criticism for them. The Americans United for the Separation of Church and State wondered how much influence Tuck might have in promoting a, quote, anti-science, anti-fact position. The Friendly Atheist blog called Tuck an evolution denier. The Progressive Secular Humanist blog wrote, "Florida's new Board of Education chair is an anti-science Christian extremist who denies evolution. Andy Tuck, an ignorant conservative Christian and a citrus farmer, is Florida's new Board of Education chair. Tuck, a self-identified, quote, person of faith, has little, if any, scientific education and demonstrates a profound ignorance that should disqualify anyone from serving in public office." And then it makes this very intriguing statement. "Evolution is the single unifying scientific explanation for the diversity of life on Earth and constitutes the foundation of the biological sciences. To deny the reality of evolution is to deny the foundation upon which modern medicine and the related biological sciences are built." That is a very telling statement. Evolution is the foundation on which so much of the world's science and education is based. On today's program, I want to help you see where evolutionary thinking has led our world. I'm not going to disprove evolution on the program today. That's a different subject. But I want to talk about where the idea that the world evolved from natural forces rather than from the product of planning, design, and purpose by a creator God takes us. We're going to start back at the beginning in the Garden of Eden. God had placed the first man and woman in the garden. Then he did something intriguing. He allowed the serpent into the garden, a being who had been a glorious archangel but had rebelled against God. Genesis 3 and verse 1 says, "Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field which the eternal God had made." That serpent is Satan the devil, and he is very subtle. He's supremely skilled at cloaking his arguments and making them sound reasonable. And this serpent spoke to Eve. He asked her about the trees in the garden, and she told him about the tree whose fruit God had forbidden them to eat because it would lead to death. Satan responded, "You shall not surely die. For God does know that in the day you eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil." He appealed to Eve's vanity. And he specifically told Eve and Adam that they would be as God. That is a very seductive proposition to human beings. And Satan has been making the same promise ever since. Many places in Scripture say that Satan rules our world today. He is the God of this world. He deceives the whole world. And you see evidence of his influence everywhere around us. The fact is, he's promoting this same argument that he made to Eve within modern education. He gets human beings to exalt themselves to the level of God in several different ways. And as we will see, terrifying things happen when human beings do that. Herbert W. Armstrong was a tremendous educator, and he spoke a lot about this incident in the Garden of Eden. In his masterful book, Mystery of the Ages, he wrote this: Adam, the first human, rejected knowledge from and reliance on God. He chose to rely on his own knowledge and abilities. The modern world, developed from Adam, relies wholly on human self-reliance. The psychology taught in our day is self-reliance. Rely on the innate powers within you, they teach. An atmosphere of self-reliant professionalism pervades most modern university campuses. It is the spirit of vanity. Now, if you can look in the Bible at what Jesus Christ said, he said, "Of my own self, I can do nothing." He was the second most powerful being ever in the universe, and yet he had total humility, total reliance on God. Satan, on the other hand, as you can read in Isaiah 14, said this: "I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will be the Most High. I will be as God. I will be God." That's the way Satan thinks. And that is essentially the lie that he told Eve. You will be as God. Not that you will be as God, but under God, but you will take God's place. And Satan has been inspiring this perverse thinking in human beings ever since. Psalm 10 expresses frustration at the world as it is apart from God. "Why do you stand afar off, O Eternal? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" it begins. When men have that self-reliance, that spirit of vanity, notice what happens. Verses 2 and 3 say, "The wicked in his pride does persecute the poor. The wicked boasts of his heart's desire and blesses the covetous whom the Lord abhors." People are proud of their sins. They boast about things that God hates. Verse 4 says, "The wicked through the pride of his countenance will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts." They push God aside altogether. And why? Because of human pride, that vanity of mind that Mr. Armstrong said forms the foundation of the modern world. The verses that follow describe a range of sins and injustices and abuses that men do when they forget God. And then verse 11 says, "He has said in his heart, God has forgotten. He hides his face. He will never see it." That is very dangerous, to think that God won't do anything about it, no matter what you do. But we see this type of thinking everywhere in the world around us. And evolution has contributed a great deal to that. The idea of a creation that came about without a creator has been taught for thousands of years, since the time of the philosophers of ancient Greece. But it was not widely accepted in the Western world, that is, until Charles Darwin sparked an academic revolution in 1859 when he published his book On the Origin of Species. This book and its sequel, The Descent of Man, argued that all organic life descended from one primordial organism. It provided a scientific hypothesis that God does not exist. And as this thinking spread, it ended up revolutionizing the world. The human self-reliance on which the whole modern world developed elevated to a whole new level. Fast forward from 1859, over 60 years, to the 1920s in America. And Mr. Armstrong wrote in his autobiography about the time in 1926 when his wife's brother, Walter Dillon, was attending classes at the University of Oregon. And Walter's wife, Hertha, was 19 years old. She was also in her freshman year at college. And what was being taught at an American college on the West Coast in 1926?
Herbert Armstrong, you are simply ignorant. One is uneducated and ignorant unless he believes in evolution. All educated people now believe it.
That is what this college freshman said in 1926. It was exactly as Mr. Armstrong described in Mystery of the Ages. An atmosphere of self-reliant professionalism pervades most modern university campuses. It is the spirit of vanity. And he continues, the university student is induced to think of himself as becoming a professional. That is, he considers himself elevated above those who have not had his brand of education. Through the basic concept of the evolutionary theory, he feels himself completely above those who believe in God and the Lord Jesus Christ. He regards them with disdain. You can see that even in a 19-year-old who had a taste of college education in 1926. Now, within the country as a whole, there was still a lot of opposition to evolution at that time. Just the year before that, in early 1925, the governor of Tennessee signed into law the Butler Act. This made it a misdemeanor for a public school instructor to teach any theory that denies the story of the divine creation of man as taught in the Bible, and to teach instead that man had descended from a lower order of animal. When lawyers from the newly formed American Civil Liberties Union heard about it, they looked for a way to challenge this law. And they found a 24-year-old part-time football coach and science teacher who had substitute taught high school biology in Dayton, Tennessee. He'd used a textbook that included material on evolution. His name was John Thomas Scopes. A case was brought against him, and there were people on all sides who were very interested in this case. It shaped up to be what was termed the trial of the century. Three-time presidential candidate William Jennings Bryan came to help with the prosecution. Clarence Darrow, the nation's most famous courtroom attorney, joined the defense. A huge media circus descended on this little town in Tennessee. It was the first trial broadcast on radio, and it riveted the nation's attention. The real question on trial was the battle between religion and science. Could American Christianity reconcile itself with science that seemed to be pushing God aside? Mr. Bryan gave an impressive defense of the Bible. He spoke about how evolution was unprovable, and he said, "It is this doctrine that gives us Nietzsche, the only great author who tried to carry this to its logical conclusion." We'll talk more about Nietzsche later in the program. But let's hear some statements from the defense.
Order! Order in the car!
We maintain that we have a right to introduce evidence by these witnesses that the theory of the defendant is not in conflict with the theory of creation in the Bible.
That was Dudley Malone, one of John Scope's defense lawyers. And the defense explicitly argued that evolution did not conflict with the Bible. They cited scientists who believed in evolution and also believed in the Bible.
We have a defendant whom we can prove by witnesses whom we have brought here. To prove, we say that there is no conflict between the Bible and whatever he taught.
It is perfectly consistent to say that man was made by a process. Perfectly consistent with the Bible. Not inconsistent with it. That he was made out of the dust of the earth. That simply gives a general statement. And there is nothing in the Bible which shows the process.
That was Clarence Darrow. It was quite a subtle argument. We're not trying to disprove the Bible. We're not saying the Bible is wrong. We're just saying science is explaining a different part of the truth. They said that there was nothing to fear about just allowing the truth to come out.
Order.
We have no fears about the young people of America. They are a pretty smart generation. Any teacher who teaches the boys or the girls of today an incredible theory, we need not worry about those children of this generation paying much attention to it. The children of this generation are pretty wise. As a matter of fact, I feel that the children of this generation are probably much wiser than many of their elders. The least that this generation can do, Your Honor, is to give to the next generation all the facts, all the available data, all the theories, all the information that learning, that study, that observation has produced. Give it to the children in the hope to heaven that they will make a better world of this than we've been able to make of it. We have just had a war with 20 million dead. Civilization is not so proud of the work of the adults. Civilization need not be so proud of what the grown-ups have done. Let the children have their minds kept open. Close no doors to their knowledge. Shut no doors from them.
That points you right back to Genesis chapter 3. It's an appeal to people's vanity. It's a promise of hidden wisdom. It says, this will open your eyes. You don't need to be afraid of this. You're not going to die. There's never a duel with the truth. The truth always wins, and we're not afraid of it. The truth is no coward. The truth does not need the law. The truth does not need the forces of government. The truth is imperishable, eternal, and immortal, and needs no human agency to support it. In other words, if this theory is wrong, it will just go away. Whatever truth there is in the Bible account, it's not in danger because of this teaching. That's the way the devil argues. You can just put truth and error out there, and truth will always win. You can mix good with evil, and your eyes will be opened, and you'll be able to tell the difference. You'll be as gods, knowing good and evil. Satan is always working to cast truth to the ground. He's trying to cast it into doubt, surround it with error, so you can't recognize it. The reality is that the truth needs defenders. It needs people who love it, or else it will be trampled. These lawyers' argument that you can just put truth and error out there, the kids will be able to figure it all out, is a satanic lie. Even at that time, you had a 19-year-old college freshman pressuring Mr. Armstrong, "If you don't believe in evolution, that just proves you're uneducated and ignorant." People are like sheep. You appeal to their vanity. You tell them, well, you'll be as God. And they'll just go along. In Romans 1, the Apostle Paul prophesied about men who hold or suppress the truth in unrighteousness. People are suppressing truth. There's deliberate deceit going on here. Verse 20 in that chapter says, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." If you look at creation, you see God. There has to be a creator. The passage goes on to say that once they eliminated God from their thinking, they became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. That is modern education, and so much of science today. In the spring of 2019, famed Yale computer science professor Dave Galanter published an article in the Claremont Review of Books titled Giving Up Darwin. He'd accepted the realization that the theory of evolution is mathematically impossible. He wrote that it was a beautiful idea, but that it's effectively been disproven. Darwinism is no longer just a scientific theory, he wrote, but the basis of a worldview and an emergency religion for the many troubled souls who need one. It's a religion, Dr. Galanter said. Of course, he was viciously attacked for writing this article. In an interview on the program Uncommon Knowledge, he said there's a scientific case for there being design and a designer behind creation. But listen to what he says about the way scientists treat that case.
It's an absolutely serious scientific argument. It's got to be dealt with intellectually, not by the bigotry, the anti-religious bigotry, which is one of the most important facts of the intellectual world in the United States, the West generally. Outside the scientific world, one might not know how ideologically bent the world of science, parts of the world of science are becoming. What I've seen in their behavior intellectually and at colleges across the West is nothing approaching free speech on this topic, is a bitter rejection, not just a sort of bitter, fundamental, angry, outraged, violent rejection, which comes nowhere near scientific or intellectual discussion. I've seen that happen again and again. I'm a Darwinism. Don't you say a word against it or I don't want to hear you, period.
Which proves that you're attacking their religion, in effect.
I am attacking their religion.
He's talking about exactly what the Apostle Paul described, men suppressing the truth. So what makes evolutionary thinking so dangerous? What are the effects of this thinking? If you believe in God, you know He is the author of morality. He defines right and wrong. What happens when you remove God from the picture? What happens if you believe Satan's lie? You get to decide what is good and what is evil. Without God, morality is just a human invention. There's no such thing as absolute right and wrong. Right and wrong is whatever you say it is. Well, this thinking is everywhere today, in our education, in politics, philosophy, entertainment. It's called moral Darwinism or moral relativism. Andrew Miller wrote an article we printed in The Trumpet in the May-June 2017 edition, The World's Most Powerful Weapon. Speaking about this way of thinking, he wrote, "It began to take deep root in the American educational system as the progressive era began in the 1890s. The ideology comes straight from the pages of Darwin's The Descent of Man. Yet even most Christian denominations in the Western world have now accepted, wittingly or unwittingly, the notion that there is no global absolute moral law that applies to all people for all time and in all places. Because society at large accepted the premise that everything is relative, including morality, evolutionists like Alfred Kinsey and Wilhelm Reich were able to propagate the idea that perversions like fornication, adultery, homosexuality, and pedophilia are not inherently evil, but are natural results of the evolutionary process and are wrong, quote unquote, because people arbitrarily say they are wrong. After all, if there is no God, marriage is not a divinely sanctioned union between a man and a woman. It is a social construct that humanity invented in order to give children their best chance at survival. If society wants to dispense with that institution, it's not fundamentally right or wrong to do so, because marriage is not right or wrong, because there is no such thing as right and wrong. What happens when you break loose from God-given moral standards? Verse 24 of Romans 1 says, "Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lusts of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves." You start taking steps down this moral road, and here's where you end up. The passage continues, "For this cause God gave them up to vile affections, for even their women did change the natural use into that which is against nature. And likewise also the men, leaving the natural use of the woman, burned in their lust one toward another, men with men, working that which is unseemly, and receiving in themselves that recompense of their error which was meet." So there's an explicit connection in this passage between these decisions by the scientific community and society embracing perverse morality. God is light, and if you get away from him, life gets darker and darker and darker. Romans 1 continues, "And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things which are not convenient, being filled with all unrighteousness, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, full of envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable, unmerciful." It's a devastating description of our modern world. The Apostle Paul does a marvelous job describing the moral wreckage that occurs when you eliminate God. We think of this as just a modern thing, but this has been happening to some degree throughout history. We've just taken it to new extremes in the modern world. And now society has been indoctrinated in evolutionary thinking for 150 years. We've accepted it into every aspect of our society. God is dead. There are no absolutes. So you see the effects of this everywhere. Gender is fluid. What you think trumps biological reality. If a woman doesn't want her baby, she can kill it. If a politician thinks he knows how wealth should be distributed, he has the right to take it from whomever he pleases. Any type of sex is okay. Drug use is okay. Assisted suicide is okay. Andrew Miller wrote, "If humanity evolved from primordial ooze, no one can say what is right or wrong, because there is no such thing. There is only the strong and the weak." We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll talk more about the consequences of this thinking. God is what gives everything meaning. If you say there is no God, all of this is just here by chance, then you eliminate all meaning, all purpose, and that is an idea with dangerous consequences. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In 1929, an American writer named Joseph Wood Crutch published a book called The Modern Temper. He believed evolution, and he thought through just what it means if there is no God, if the entire universe is just an accident. And he was honest about the implications. Essentially, modern man went from believing in a benevolent creator who did everything for a reason, who had love for his creation, who knows even when a sparrow falls to the ground, who counts all the hairs on your head, to believing in an impersonal force of nature which has no purpose. It is arbitrary, and everything it does arbitrarily. And this is terrifying. He wrote this.
Formerly, man had believed in even his darkest moments that the universe was rational, if he could only grasp its rationality. But gradually, he comes to suspect that rationality is an attribute of himself alone, and there is no reason to suppose that his own life has any more meaning than the life of the humblest insect that crawls from one annihilation to another. Nature, in her blind thirst for life, has filled every possible cranny of the rotting earth with some sort of fantastic creature, and among them, man is but one. Perhaps the most miserable of all, because he is the only one in whom the instinct of life falters long enough to enable it to ask the question, why? As long as life is held to have been created, creating may be held to imply a purpose, but merely to have come into being is, in all likelihood, merely to go out of it also.
This gives you a good idea of just how depressing it is to be an atheist, to believe in evolution, to believe in a godless universe. It is hopeless. As Andrew Miller wrote, if humanity is only a distant cousin of insects, as Darwin proposed, then the 7 million people who would die in a thermonuclear strike on New York City are no different from the 7 million ants dying of boric acid poisoning in a routine pest control procedure today down the street from your house. Joseph Wood Crutch wrote about how the more we trusted science, the smaller and weaker God became.
The role which he plays grows less and less, and man is left more and more alone in a universe to which he is completely alien. For the dream which he made is substituted a reality devoid of any pattern which he can understand. In 60-odd years which have elapsed since the origin of species, the blows have fallen with a rapidity which left no interval for recovery. The world which his reason and investigation reveal is a world which his emotions cannot comprehend. Casually, he accepts the spiritual iconoclasm of science, and in the detachment of everyday life, he learns to play with the cynical wisdom of biology and psychology. He is reduced to mocking his torn and divided soul.
The purely material explanation of the universe is chilling. It is terrifying and meaningless. All is a void, a vacuum. And this is inescapable if there is no God. It is as the Apostle Paul wrote, "If Christ be not raised, your faith is vain. You are yet in your sins. Then they also which are fallen asleep in Christ are perished. If in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men most miserable." What a miserable existence, if this is all there is, if there's no meaning, no purpose. Paul said, if the dead rise not, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. That's the way the great majority of people in this world think. This is what our young people are being taught. What a waste human existence is. William Jennings Bryan said, "The only great author who tried to carry Darwin's thinking to its logical conclusion was Friedrich Nietzsche." In an article for Philosophy Now, H. James Birks explained how Nietzsche was inspired by Darwin's ideas. Evolution, as he saw it, has far-reaching truths. God is no longer necessary to account for either the existence of this universe or the emergence of our species from prehistoric animals. In fact, this philosopher held that Darwinian evolution led to a collapse of all traditional values because both objective meaning and spiritual purpose had vanished from reality. and consequently, there can be no fixed or certain morality. As a result, a totally new philosophy of the world was now required. Here is what Nietzsche wrote in his 1882 book, The Gay Science.
God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us?
This man was intellectually honest enough to know what it would mean if there were no God. He knew that all meaning was rooted in that belief.
What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? Must we ourselves not become gods, simply to appear worthy of it? Behold, I teach you the Übermensch.
Übermensch, meaning overman or superman. Nietzsche criticized Christianity for putting people's focus on another world. Now, this was partly because of the false concept of dualism, that you have an immortal soul separate from a physical body. That leads to asceticism, or punishing the body, or saying you shouldn't enjoy any pleasure, that the only real fulfillment will come in the next life. These are errors. Some of the things that Nietzsche was criticizing about religion are actually errors. But his solution is this overman. He says that the will of the overman will give meaning to life on earth. In other words, you shall be as gods. Nietzsche believed Christian values were a reaction against life and destructive, but that we could create new values that would be life-affirming and creative. Again, some of the Christian value system that he reacted against was Satan's counterfeit of God's truth and God's religion. But think about how arrogant and perverse this philosophy is. The idea that Christianity is against life and destructive, and human beings are going to create new values that affirm life. That's exactly what Satan wants people to think, and it is dangerously wrong. The psalmist wrote, "Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine or meditate a vain thing or emptiness?" So much of what this world devises is vain and empty. Take God out of the picture, and that's what you have. This is from Psalm 2. The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Eternal and against His anointed, saying, "Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us." They don't want to be ruled by God, so they devise any means possible of breaking free from His rule, even if it means concocting some way of erasing Him altogether, inventing a way that the entire creation could have come about without Him. That requires some incredible imagination and deceit. What must God think when He hears scientists putting forward all these intricate ideas of how this all came about without Him? This psalm continues, "He that sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision." Surely it is amusing to God to hear scientists so impressed with their own reasoning. But that's not His only emotion. He also gets very angry. The psalm also says, "Then He shall speak unto them in His wrath and vex them in His sore displeasure." He is going to forcibly deal with this arrogance of man. Nietzsche spent the last 12 years of his life in a mental institution. That's what this mindset leads to. Where does evolutionary thinking lead society? The idea that God is dead, man has taken his place, human reason is the ultimate authority, and everything is getting better and better. Each generation is growing more highly evolved than the last. Mankind is constantly improving. This thinking has completely changed society. The idea now is that the younger are better than the older. The older might as well die off. This leads to, well, why listen to our elders? We're more advanced. What do they have to teach us? Society idolizes youth. It thinks young people are the answers to all our problems. This idea that new is better than old, it infects our sense of morality. Moral evolution has outstripped the idea of biological evolution by a million times. You see it in so many places, such as the notion in America that the Constitution is outdated. It needs to evolve with the times. We're better morally than we were in 1787. We're on a higher plane of understanding and culture. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God, says Psalm 14. If someone is a fool for saying this in his heart, what about the man who says it in public, on television, in university lecture halls? The psalm continues, they are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none that does good. Again, you see the connection between no God and corrupt, abominable works. This psalm talks about the kind of corruption and injustice that begins to flourish when human beings have no higher authority. Again, if humanity evolved from primordial ooze, no one can say what is right or wrong because there is no such thing. There is only the strong and the weak. Think about that. When America was founded, its Declaration of Independence said that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If the rights of human beings are given by God, then you'd better respect them. But once you remove God from that picture, then what are human rights? If God didn't give them, then who did? And what's to stop you from taking them away? Well, instead of trying to limit the power of government to protect our individual rights, which God gave us, atheists often try to get control of people and governments and expand their power to the point that they implement their own ideas of how things should work. This is the logic that led to communism. An American named Whitaker Chambers was a communist. He wrote a memoir in 1952 called Witness. He argued that Joseph Stalin's Gulag Archipelago was the inevitable result of Russia's embrace of Darwinist-inspired atheism. If you want to see the ultimate end of evolutionary thinking, communism is excellent to study. And the fact that it's becoming more and more popular in America today makes it all the more important to study. Communism exploded onto the scene as a result of the nightmares of World Wars I and II. Whitaker Chambers makes this point.
The chief fruit of the First World War was the Russian Revolution and the rise of communism as a national power. The chief fruit of the Second World War was our arrival at the next to the last step of the crisis with the rise of communism as a world power. History is likely to say that these were the only decisive results of the world wars.
As the lawyer in the Scopes trial said, these incredibly destructive events showed that the adults really don't know what they're doing. The world was in crisis. At the same time, the world was coming to grips with this empty, nihilistic view of the universe that science was giving them. And communists came along and said, "We have the answer." Herbert W. Armstrong wrote this in a letter to Plain Truth subscribers, November 24, 1967. The world crisis had already started prior to World War I. Only most of the people of the world were not yet aware of it. But men like Karl Marx and Nikolai Lenin knew. This world crisis resulted from the impact of science and technology and the injection of godless German rationalism into education. He's essentially talking about the idea that human reason is the highest source of knowledge. He wrote, "World wars are the military expression of that crisis. Worldwide depressions are the economic expression. The so-called new morality is the moral expression, plummeting morals into the cesspool. Universal desperation is the spiritual expression. This has spawned the beatniks and the hippies, the riots, the marches, the civil disobedience, the breakdown of law and order. These are all products of Darwinism and evolution, and it all creates a climate that communism can thrive in." Mr. Armstrong wrote this in The Plain Truth of March 1966. "Why do some people, even college professors and some who are intellectually inclined, become communists? Because they see many things wrong in this world, they want to be right, they grasp communism as a last straw and only hope under the delusion that they can have a part in making this a better world. They want to be right, but they don't want to do right, so they grasp the straw that makes the lying and false promises of producing the solution. But communism is only another idea of man based on human nature. It is a theoretical way that would destroy what little good there might be in this world's society. It is the most false of false hopes." Whitaker Chambers wrote this,
"Communism makes some profound appeal to the human mind. Communists are bound together by no secret oath. The tie that binds them across the frontiers of nations, across barriers of language and differences of class and education, in defiance of religion, morality, truth, law, honor, even unto death, is a simple conviction. It is necessary to change the world. Communists are that part of mankind which has recovered the power to live or die, to bear witness for its faith. It is not new. It is, in fact, man's second oldest faith. Its promise was whispered in the first days of creation under the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Ye shall be as gods. It is the great alternative faith of mankind."
Chambers says all religions come from some vision of God and man's relationship to God. But
the communist vision is the vision of man without God. It is the vision of man's mind displacing God as the creative intelligence of the world.
So the communists recognize these problems. They believe they alone can solve them. They alone have the answers.
On this plane of faith, communism summons mankind to turn its vision into practical reality. On the plane of action, it summons men to struggle against the inertia of the past. Its challenge to man is, have you the moral strength to take upon yourself the crimes of history so that man at last may close his chronicle of age-old, senseless suffering and replace it with purpose and a plan?
They're saying, in effect, are you willing to go all the way in realizing this vision? If you believe there is no God, and you believe mankind's fate is in mankind's hands, then how far are you willing to go to establish your version of utopia on earth? When Jesus Christ returns to establish the kingdom of God, it's going to involve a lot of bloodshed. He won't be able to remake the world according to his government and his law without that, sadly. But what happens if it's not the all-loving creator God who is undertaking that revolution? What if it is Satan-inspired men who realize that the only way they can bring about the world of their dreams and to get rid of poverty and unhappiness and injustice is at a very high cost? What happens when man doesn't believe there's any authority higher than himself, and he must eliminate those who would stand in the way of him realizing this vision? Andrew Miller wrote, "Would you be willing to kill someone if you believed doing so would ease poverty and create a more equitable world? Would you be willing to kill a countless number of people who were preventing paradise? In Stalinist Russia, over 20 million people were executed, starved, or worked to death in the evolutionary struggle between social classes. In atheistic China, the state slaughtered 40 million people and actually encouraged teenagers to literally eat school principals suspected of counter-revolutionary sympathies. Some 3 million North Koreans have been murdered in a state-sanctioned attempt to purge society of the concept that inalienable rights exist. These millions of grisly murders starkly violate God's moral law, but they did not violate the man-made morality of the societies that perpetuated them. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. How foolish man has been, and how destructive by trying to put himself in God's place. The world has lost its faith in God and replaced it with a faith in man. The further we are from God, the more susceptible we are to Satan's lies, and the more we will put ourselves and other people in the place of God. Andrew Miller wrote, the blast radius of a Soviet RDS-220 hydrogen bomb is 45 miles. But the destruction unleashed by moral lawlessness, the logical conclusion of the evolutionary theory, has become entrenched in most of modern civilization. This makes moral relativism over 1,000 times more destructive than the Tsar Bomba. How widespread, how far-reaching, and how dangerous evolution is. The reality is that that moral relativism is what is driving humanity to the brink of actually annihilating ourselves with those weapons of mass destruction. The moral relativism and evolutionary progressivism radiating through society would lead to the extinction of all life on Earth unless God intervenes. Whitaker Chambers said that what broke him out of communism was a moment when he was in his apartment in Baltimore. His daughter was in her high chair, and he was watching her eat.
She was the most miraculous thing that had ever happened in my life. I liked to watch her even when she smeared porridge on her face. My eye came to rest on the delicate convolutions of her ear, those intricate, perfect ears. The thought passed through my mind. No, those ears were not created by any chance coming together of atoms and nature, the communist view. They could have been created only by immense design.
He tried to push the thought out of his mind, but he couldn't. He realized design presupposes God. What began to set him free was his recognition that evolution was a lie.
One thing most ex-communists could agree upon, they broke because they wanted to be free. Freedom is a need of the soul and nothing else. It is in striving toward God that the soul strives continually after a condition of freedom.
God alone is the inciter and guarantor of freedom. He is the only guarantor. External freedom is only an aspect of interior freedom. Political freedom, as the Western world has known it, is only a political reading of the Bible. Religion and freedom are indivisible.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. This is what Psalm 111 says. Praise you, the Lord. I will praise the Lord with my whole heart in the assembly of the upright and in the congregation. The works of the Lord are great, sought out of all them that have pleasure therein. His work is honorable and glorious, and his righteousness endures forever. He has made his wonderful works to be remembered. The Eternal is gracious and full of compassion. He has given meat unto them that fear him. He will ever be mindful of his covenant. He has showed his people the power of his works, that he may give them the heritage of the heathen. The works of his hands are verity and judgment. All his commandments are sure. They stand fast forever and ever, and are done in truth and uprightness. He sent redemption unto his people. He has commanded his covenant forever. Holy and reverend is his name. The fear of the Eternal is the beginning of wisdom. A good understanding have all they that do his commandments. His praise endures forever. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. I'll leave you with this thought from Jonathan Swift: that the universe was formed by a fortuitous concourse of atoms, I will no more believe than that the accidental jumbling of the alphabet would fall into a most ingenious treatise of philosophy. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. And online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.